Call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 23rd, 2025. The time is 3:45 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present: Senator Hughes, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Myers, Senator Dunbar, Vice Chair Wilikowski, myself, Senator Giesel. I expect Senator Klayman to be along shortly. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Dennis. Thank you for helping us out today. We have three items on the agenda. The first one is Senate Joint Resolution 8, International Relations with Taiwan. Then we'll hear Senate Joint Resolution 19, that's ANWR. And then Senate Bill 176, Approved Marathon, Petro Royalty Oil Sale. First up, Senate Joint Resolution 8, I'll have Senator L.V. Gray Jackson come to the table. We've heard this bill before. On, looks like about the 14th or so of April. It is a resolution. If you'd like to give us a brief refresher on what the resolution pertains to.
Senator Gray Jackson, representing District G in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. I want to thank the committee, the chair, and the committee members for hearing this bill again. SJR 8, it reaffirms Alaska's commitment to strengthening its relationship with Taiwan, and it recognizes the deep economic, cultural, and educational ties between our state and our international partner in Taiwan. By passing this resolution, we can reaffirm Alaska's dedication to fostering a strong and mutually benefit relationship. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. We have had public testimony on this, and so I did leave it open. So at this time, we'll open public testimony. I see no one online wishing to testify. Is there anyone here in the room that would like to testify on Senate Joint Resolution 8? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. My office received no amendments, and so I will look to the Vice Chair for a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Madam Chair, I move to report SJR 8, Work Order 34-LS0442-A, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Legislative legal has the authority to make any technical and conforming changes.
Is there objection? Seeing none, SJR 8 will move from this committee. We will sign the transmittal paperwork after the committee meeting. Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Next up is Senate Joint Resolution 19. This is related to ANWR. That's the Alaska National Wildlife Reserve and the National Petroleum Reserve state share. We have heard this bill before. I will invite Laura Ashi forward. She is staff to Senator Bjorkman, who is the sponsor of this resolution. Do you have any comments to make to refresh us on the content of this resolution?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Laura Ashe. I'm staff to Senator Jesse Bjorkman, Senate District D. And briefly, this resolution does urge Congress to reverse its decision to only allow Alaska to receive 50% of the revenues from development of oil and gas resources in ANWR, which is federal land. This was the promise made to Alaska during statehood in the Statehood Act and in the Mineral Act. Furthermore, we included in the resolution a request that Alaska receive 90% of the revenues from production in the MPRA, which was not included in the Statehood Act, was not included in the Mineral Leasing Act. But, Madam Chair, as you teed me up for a question last time that I got lost in the weeds on, that 50% that Alaska receives on MPRA production doesn't come to the state of Alaska for use across the entire state. It does get focus primarily on a very specific region of the state and then some other very specific programs. So Alaska actually has to take on the work of supporting that production through permitting and other things, but doesn't, in fact, has write-offs against revenues that the state takes in from that production without seeing anything going into the state general fund. And so even though that wasn't included in the original statehood bill or the Mineral Leasing Act, Senator Bjorkman thought it was appropriate to ask for that also for the 90% of revenues from production in the MPRA.
Thank you, Ms. Ashe. Any questions for Ms. Ashe? All right. Thank you very much for that. We do have a committee substitute to present to the committee today. I'm going to ask my vice chair for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Senate Resources CS for SJR 8, Work Order 34-LS0840/8H as our working document.
And I will object for purposes of discussion. I will have my staff come forward and review the slight tweak to the resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Intamayo Harbison, staff to Senator Giesel. The only change that we've made between the previous version and the CS is on page 1, lines 6 and 7, we've removed any reference to the federal administration and instead reiterated that the Alaska legislature is grateful for the approval and development of the Willow Project and other projects within the NPRA. And that is the totality of the changes, Madam Chair.
Any questions, comments from the committee? Seeing none, I will remove my objection, thus adopting this committee substitute. We did have public testimony on this resolution on April 14th. It was opened and closed. I see no one else online. Is there anyone in the room that might want to testify on SJR 19? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. So I will look to my vice chair for a motion.
I move to report the committee substitute for SJR 19, Work Order 34-LS084H, out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Legislative legal has the authority to make any technical and conforming changes.
Seeing no objection, the resolution moves from committee. I will note that it has a zero fiscal note. Thank you very much for being here, Ms. O'Shea. Next up, we'll sign the transmittal documents at the end of the meeting. Next up, we have Senate Bill 176, Approved Marathon Petro Royalty Oil Sale. So here to present today this bill for the first time is Derek Nottingham and Ryan Fitzpatrick. Both are from the Division of Oil and Gas in the Department of Natural Resources. So welcome, gentlemen. And online we have, I have the bill there somewhere. There we go. Deputy Commissioner John Crowther.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Giesel, Vice Chair Wilikowski, members of the Senate Resources Committee. We thank you for the opportunity to speak today on Senate Bill 176. For the record, I'm Derek Nottingham, the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and with me is Ryan Fitzpatrick, Commercial Section Manager for the Division. So we're here to ask for your endorsement of Senate Bill 176, which is a bill that allows the state to execute a contract for the sale of royalty oil to Marathon Petroleum. The state and Marathon are nearing the end of a current 3-year contract for royalty in kind, which expires at the end of July. The new contract will be a 3-year primary term with options for 1-year extensions to sell between 10 and 15,000 barrels of oil per day of royalty in kind oil to Marathon. So the state has a long-standing practice of selling its portion of royalty as oil in kind when that maximizes the benefits to the citizens of Alaska. This contract facilitates that by capturing a price premium for royalty in kind oil that's sold in state as opposed to royalty in value oil that's marketed and sold on the West Coast. The premium in this contract will generate additional revenue of approximately $4 million to $18 million over the life of the contract. Further, our royalty oil provides a secure source of feedstock oil, in this case for the Kenai refinery for Marathon, which produces gasoline, jet fuel, and other products that are used here in Alaska. Alaska statutes require that the Commissioner of DNR make a determination and best interest finding that this is in the state's best interest. That has been done. Alaska statutes also require that the State Royalty Board issue a resolution and report stating that the required statutes have been met for this contract. That's also provided to the committee. And finally, the contract must be approved by the legislature, and so that's why we're here today. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brian, and he's going to walk us through the presentation.
Very good. Brief at ease. I call the Senate Resources Committee back to order. So, welcome, Mr. Fitzpatrick. You are going to give us a PowerPoint presentation.
Yes, thank you very much. For the record, Ryan Fitzpatrick, commercial manager at the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas. So we're here to present Senate Bill 176. So first off, just to walk the committee through what is royalty in kind. The state of Alaska has oil and gas leases, obviously, with our producers, both in Cook Inlet and the North Slope. Those oil and gas leases allow the state to take a percentage of the production from those leases as a royalty. We have two options for how we can take that royalty oil. The first option is that we can take that royalty in value, which is where the state allows the producer to market our royalty share of oil alongside its production. The producer sells that to whichever company that it's selling that oil onto, and then we receive a share of the proceeds from that sale equivalent to the percentage of our royalty from that sale. The second option the state has is to take our royalty in kind. Instead of allowing the producer to market our oil alongside its own, this is where the state has the option of taking the oil physically in kind, and then we market and sell the oil ourselves. And so that is the option that this contract would be pursuing, would be taking a portion of our production from the North Slope, marketing it in kind, in this case, to the Marathon Refinery at Nikiski. And I can stop at the end of each slide if folks want, or we can just keep going.
I don't see Senator Kleinman has a question.
This is a question that often comes up with members of the public that start talking with me about what's in the pipeline. Without regard to whether it's sold through the companies or whether it's in kind, if one thinks about the volume of oil going through the pipeline, what percentage of that is royalty oil that essentially is the state's oil as opposed to belongs to one of the companies? And I know that may be a call for a complicated answer, but...
The exact percentage is going to vary depending on the field. We have leases up on the North Slope. The predominantly our producing leases have a 12.5% royalty share. We do have leases that are under production that have a 16 2/3% royalty share. And so depending on the percentage of production that comes from leases with those different royalty shares, the exact percentage is going to vary over time. But somewhere between sort of those two numbers is the approximate percentage of the oil that is flowing through the pipeline at any one point that is state royalty oil. Just given the vintage of the leases and where most of the production is coming from, it's usually closer to that 12.5, 13, 13.5% percentage point rather than closer to the 16 2/3. But, yeah, over time, that's approximately where it ends up being. And right now that works out to apologies, a little bit closer to the microphone. Right now that works out to be approximately 50,000 barrels a day of state royalty production.
Follow-up, Senator Kleinman.
And so when we hear all the – again, this is more so that folks in the public that are watching, when we talk about oil and – there's oil and gas taxes, which is essentially on the percentage that doesn't belong to the state. That's what we collect taxes on, those oil. And then – but other revenue that comes into the state for our budget is actually – some of that is the money we make off selling our royalty oil.
That's correct, yeah. The state oil and gas fiscal system includes the royalty percentage, which is that percentage that the state receives as its share of the production. And then the oil and gas production tax is separately levied on the producer's share of that production. That program obviously is administered by our friends at Department of Revenue. On top of that, there is an oil and gas property tax that also is another component of that fiscal system. Most of that ends up being received by the local jurisdictions. However, the state does receive a part of that as well.
And I think we'll
follow up, Senator Kleinman.
And then when we get into the what's been getting going to Marathon as a in kind, that oil, once it gets to Marathon, Marathon's actually paying the state for that oil as well.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Klayman, that's correct. When we sell the oil in kind, we forward sell that oil to Marathon Refining. We've got a slide coming up in a little bit that goes through the pricing mechanism specifically for that. But yeah, the state receives that payment from Marathon for the oil that we're selling in kind.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I'll let you go on.
Okay. Just really quick, this already discussed this, I think, at length, royalty. It's one of the core lease terms. We have here an example of one of our oil and gas leases. This one is dated 2002 and reflects that that royalty percentage that's a part of that lease and one of the real core lease terms for the state when it's leasing its oil and gas property.
I see no questions.
Okay. The next slide is a map of our North Slope producing area. It shows state oil and gas leases and the associated units that those leases are grouped into. And so this is the area where the state is predominantly taking its oil as royalty in kind. Although we do have production coming out of the Cook Inlet, that production, the state's royalty share of that production is insufficient to meet the requested volumes that Marathon has asked for as part of this contract. And so predominantly we take our royalty and kind oil from producing leases in the North Slope. And so from month to month it can vary which particular unit we may take that royalty oil from, but it's coming off of state leases on the North Slope to satisfy these contracts.
I see no questions.
So the next slide reflects a history of the state's royalty in kind sales program. The state has functionally sold a percentage of its royalty oil as royalty in kind, essentially since about the startup of the operations at Prudhoe Bay. The chart you see on this slide shows the total royalty volume. That's the combined percentage of those two charts or those two lines. The green set of the bars there reflects the percentage of the total royalty production that the state is actually selling in kind. So you can see over time, the amount of oil that we've sold in kind varies from year to year. In some years, it approaches 95% of our production that we're actually selling in kind. Over time, though, that percentage has evened out to somewhere in the 40 to 50% range. And then, as you can tell, there's sort of monthly variations in there. That's mostly to do with the fact that most of our royalty and kind sales recently have gone to in-state refining sector. Those in-state refineries do have occasional monthly turnarounds, essentially monthly maintenance periods. And so there are times where they're taking less royalty and kind for, you know, a month or so. And so that explains some of the variations that you see in there. But overall, it's, you know, on a monthly basis, it's somewhere between about a third and half of the state's royalty production is being sold in kind.
I see no questions.
All right. This next slide reflects the history of, again, the history of our royalty in kind sales. This is looking at the actual contracts that the state has executed over a number of years going back to late 1970s. As you can see, we've had contracts for royalty in kind sales going back, you know, decades. Importantly, the two lines towards the right-hand side of that chart reflect the current royalty in kind contracts that the state has. One of those contracts is with the Marathon Refinery in Nikiski. That's the contract that we're hoping to extend with this particular Senate bill. The other contract is with Petrostar. Petrostar operates refineries in Fairbanks and in Valdez. They take oil directly off of the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. When Petrostar renewed their contract in 2022, they negotiated a 5-year renewal term at that point in time. And so Petrostar's contract isn't up for renewal this year. We would expect to be back in front of the legislature in a year or two with a potential new contract for Petrostar. Marathon's contract, as Director Nottingham indicated earlier, does expire this year, and so that's why we're in front of the legislature this year to renew that Marathon contract.
Very good. Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thanks. And I don't know, there might be, I'm just paging through the slides, there might be a better slide to answer this question. But I had a question about the non-competitive sales versus competitive sales. I guess I'm trying to figure out, are there a lot of people that request these types of contracts? And if it's not competitive, how exactly does that work? Are they just automatically recognized as RIK being the best way to do business? Thanks.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, probably a couple of points to bring up in response to that question, and thank you very much. In terms of the non-competitive contracts, before we enter into these RIK sales for Marathon or Petrostar, we go through a solicitation of interest process where we actually publish a public notice requesting any expressions of interest for purchases of the state's royalty oil. Historically, going back the last decade or so, the only companies that have responded with concrete interest have been Marathon and Petrostar. We have had discussions with other potentially interested buyers. None of those discussions have materialized into concrete offers for sale, but that is part of the reason that we go through that notice of potential offer process each time, is to see whether there's going to be a market that would support a competitive sale. If it's just the two in-state refiners, though, those in-state refiners don't have the demand to take the entirety of the state's royalty oil. And so in that case, that's where we default to negotiated contracts. With regard to the pricing term, again, we've got an explanation a little bit further on about the pricing term. But part of what we look for in those negotiated sales contracts is to make sure that we obtain some form of premium for the state above the amount that we would expect to obtain for those sales if those sales were part of the royalty and value sales that we talked about earlier. So we always want to make sure that when we're selling royalty in kind, that we're doing better than what we would expect to do for royalty and value.
Great. Thank you.
All right. I'll let you move on.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So the next slide touches a little bit on our process. I believe Director Nottingham already talked through this a little bit, but as he mentioned, we have a process that we go through for these royalty and kind sales. We have the expression of interests that goes out to public notice. We go through a best interest finding, both a preliminary and final best interest finding that's open for public comment. And then we go through the royalty board's review process. They have voted on this particular contract, recommending its adoption by the legislature, and I believe that report is part of what's in front of the committee today. And then the final step there is ratification by the legislature.
I see no questions.
And then this is just to follow up on the royalty board's review. This is an excerpt from the Royalty Board's resolution and report to the legislature, the full version of which was provided to the committee.
No questions.
This next slide goes through the criteria that the Royalty Board examines when looking at one of these contracts to determine whether or not to recommend its adoption by the legislature. You can see all of the different items that the Royalty Board reviews as part of its review for these contracts. Issues such as the revenue needs of the state, the existence of in-state refining and the need to support the in-state refining sector, local capital investments, social impacts, jobs, et cetera. And so when these contracts are presented to the Royalty Board, they consider all of these factors. Those are part of the report that's in front of the legislature, but it's a rather extensive and in-depth examination of these contracts before they come to the legislature.
Any questions? Senator Kawasaki.
So if the Royalty Review Board says there's like a certain number of jobs or these types of things are going to occur, does anybody verify that whether that actually happens?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, I believe the employment status of the jobs that are supported by the Marathon refining complex, I believe that's something that's commonly a part of the royalty board's review process. When we go through and prepare the best interest finding when we're going through the initial contract, that's something that we independently verify and ends up as part of the best interest finding, looking at what the employment numbers are for the refinery in Nikiski. And I believe we go through this the same process for the refineries for Petrostar when that contract is up as well. But, yeah, that's something we definitely look at. And we look at the employment as, you know, being one of the significant reasons that the state wants to support the in-state refining sector. It's also part of our statutory guidance directed by the legislature that part of our royalty in kind program is intended to support the in-state refining sector as well.
Great. Thank you.
All right. No more questions.
So the next slide goes through our recent royalty in kind sales contracts. The final row on this particular chart shows the contract that's under consideration for this particular legislation. But you can see the rows above that reflect previous contracts with Marathon and Petrostar. I'm going to take the opportunity here to call out two new contract terms that were included in this particular contract that are slightly different from what we've done in the past. Actually, looking at this one again, I see this one has one of those items. The other one appears in a substantially similar chart on another couple of slides later. But this particular contract has a 3-year primary term, but it has 7 1-year option terms. Previously, our last contract with Marathon only had a 3-year primary term and didn't have those option years. We've included the option years this year after discussion with Marathon. That was something both the department and Marathon were interested in potentially looking at. And those option years allow us to extend the term of the contract up to a total of 10 years, assuming both the state and Marathon are happy with how the contract is performing at that point. After that 3-year term, both parties have to agree for an additional 1-year period to extend that contract. If either party is unhappy with how the contract is performing at that point, either party has the option of pulling out of that contract. But if both parties are satisfied, it gives us the option of continuing to extend that contract over a longer period of term. Simplifies the administrative process for both the state and for Marathon. And from Marathon's perspective, gives them a longer-term certainty in terms of their potential to obtain supplies of crude oil to help support that refinery from the state.
Question. Senator Klayman.
First question is, under the extensions, would each extension have to come back in front of the legislature for approval, or if we approve it as proposed, each year the state and Marathon would be able to go and just sign off and agree to the extension?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, because the option years are part of the contract that's in front of the legislature right now, those extension options could be exercised by the department and wouldn't have to come back in front of the legislature each year.
Variation.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman.
What happens if, say, in you're on the third extension and both the state and Marathon think that they should extend, but there's an agreement to modify one or two terms in the contract so that it's not identical to the extension, but it is a modification? Would that need to come to the legislature for the modification?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, thank you. Really good question. The statutes actually do direct that if there is a modification of terms of a contract, that then has to go back to the legislature before it can be executed. So, yeah, if there's a modification as part of that extension, then that would come back before the legislature.
Thank you.
Thank you. No further questions. I'll let you go on.
Okay. And then just real quick before I exit this slide, I think we mentioned it before, but just to call out, the nomination volume for this particular contract is 10 to 15,000 barrels per day. And that just continues the same volume as the current contract that's expiring this year. The next slide goes through our competitive versus non-competitive sales process. I believe we discussed this a little bit earlier, but again, just to call out, the department does go through a process of soliciting interest to see if there is a market that would support competitive sales. We've had some discussions, but nothing that has developed into concrete sales offers. And so that's why the department continues to negotiate directly with the in-state refining sector for direct sales.
No questions.
Okay. The next slide discusses the in-state priority for the state for the sale of state royalty in kind oil. I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but Alaska Statute 3805-183D does provide that DNR is supposed to look to satisfy in-state demand for crude oil for the refining sector before engaging in any out-of-state sales. Right now, it's the Marathon and Petrostar refinery complexes that are the two sources of in-state demand. And so we do have to look to make sure that those demands are satisfied before we can look at potential out-of-state sales that would actually be any, you know, competitive sales. However, as I said earlier, that we haven't had out-of-state sales that have materialized in recent times. It's just been the two in-state refining complexes.
Good. No questions.
This slide reflects the historical premium that the state has received for its RIK sales. As I alluded to before, when we sell our oil as royalty in kind, as opposed to taking it as royalty in value, our objective is always to do at least a little bit better selling that oil in kind than we would expect to receive for that same oil in value. So in effect, to try and obtain a premium for the sale of that oil for the state. This slide reflects the results of that that program over the history going back to about 2008. On this graph, for any of those dots that appear above that $0 line across the middle of the chart, that reflects a month in which our RIK sales program obtained a premium over what equivalent RIV barrels, royalty and value barrels, DNR received. So those are months that we actually did obtain that that premium over the equivalent for royalty and value. As you can see, the vast majority of those months, we do manage to obtain a premium through our RIK sales. There are months where, you know, through different for different reasons, most having to do with the oil market. You can see in 2020 there was a little bit of disruption in the oil market. There are months where we don't obtain that premium, but the vast majority of those months were successful in obtaining a premium over our RIV barrels. And so that provides for a premium on top of the RIV barrels that results in additional revenue to the state, to the, both the general fund and goes to the permanent fund as well.
No questions.
This slide, slide number 14, reflects the RIK process that we've talked about previously. As we discussed, DNR goes through the process of negotiating the RIK contracts with our purchasers. Those RIK contracts then go to we go through the solicitation of interest, negotiate the contracts, and then those contracts go out for a best interest finding. We receive public comments on the best interest finding, or we are open to receiving comments on the best interest finding. This particular best interest finding did not receive any public comments. Following the close of the public comment period, we then publish a final best interest finding. We go to the royalty board, present to them. They go through their analysis, and we receive that resolution and report from the royalty board. And then after the close of that, both the public comment period, the final best interest finding, and the royalty board's report, that's when we bring these contracts to the state legislature. So right now we're on step 11, legislative approval. That's the end of our process. So if the legislature does grant approval to this particular contract, we'd then be in a position where we can execute the contract and begin selling those barrels to Marathon later this year when their current contract expires.
Very good. No questions.
Slide number 15 reflects contract terms for our recent contracts. And this is the second of the two charts that I wanted to call out a difference in one of our contract terms with this particular contract as opposed to what we've done previously. On the last row on this particular chart, you can see what we call the RIK differential. And this is part of the key pricing term for how we price oil for these sales contracts. Like all commercial contracts for in-state sales of Alaska North Slope crude, we begin with a West Coast price index. Those are published by commercial price quotation companies, Platts, Reuters, Argus. Those are common data sources that are used both by the state for different purposes and in private contracts for sales of ANS, Alaska North Slope crude, basically throughout the commercial environment. So we use those contract or those price quotations. Other commercial operators use those same price quotations, and that is a West Coast price for the sale of oil. In order to generate a in-state sales price, purchasers recognize that the West Coast price includes a marine transportation component. That is a cost of transporting that that oil from the Valdez terminal to the West Coast market. And so when there's a sale in the state, there's a differential that is an approximation of that marine transportation cost to create functionally an artificial price for the sale of oil in Alaska. It's the recognition that that West Coast price isn't the same as the price in Alaska. And so it's a small deduction from the value of the barrel of oil on the West Coast. That doesn't always equal the marine transportation cost. The marine transportation cost does tend to be a little bit larger than the RIK differential that we see for in-state sales. And that's part of the premium that the state does receive when we sell these barrels of oil in-state. As you can see, previously, the department had negotiated that RIK differential on a fixed value basis. And so for the history of the contracts going back the last decade or so, you can see previous contracts had an RIK differential of $1.95 a barrel or $2.17 a barrel. This year, what we've done differently is instead of negotiating a fixed RIK differential, we've looked to the Department of Revenue, which has access to all of the contracts for sales of oil in the state of Alaska. And what they do is publish on an annual basis a prevailing value for that location differential, looking at all the contracts that are occurring for sales of oil in the state. Those contracts all have similar pricing terms using that location differential. And so DOR publishes a weighted volume average of a volume weighted average of those location differentials for sales that are occurring in the state of Alaska. So this year, instead of negotiating a fixed RIK differential, we actually refer specifically to that DOR price. So we're using essentially the market index price for that location differential. And then we subtract 24 cents from that price. By subtracting from that price, we're reducing the amount that that's being deducted from the state, and so we're earning an additional premium on top of that in-state premium that I mentioned earlier. So there's sort of two sources of the premium that we obtain for those RIK sales, but by moving to this index, referring specifically over to this Department of Revenue index price, we know two things. Number one, that we've locked in our price advantage relative to the market for that location differential. And we also know, number two, that as we looked at potential for an extended term for this particular contract, that as we expect that that RIK differential to move over time, we know that if we have a now potential for an extended 10-year term for this contract, that our pricing term isn't going to end up out of the water relative to the market for that RIK differential. So that was sort of the first pricing term or the first difference in term that we discussed with Marathon. And it was as we were discussing that potential to move to this sort of market index pricing mechanism that we then started discussing the potential for an extended term for this contract.
Gotcha. Thank you. I see no questions. Senator Wilkowski had a question.
Thank you. Have you sought legal advice on whether or not this complies with the Alaska Constitution and the provision that we can't bind future legislatures?
As far as that particular issue, I think the I don't know that we had specific recommendation from the Department of Law about that. However, the Department of Law was extensively involved in the development of the contract itself. And these RIK contracts have been brought before the legislature as a matter of course, going back, you know, a number of years. The statutes that we operate under specifically provide for extended sales of greater than 1 year duration for these RIK sales. It's actually the shorter duration sales that the department has a limited authority to enter into without legislative authority. And again, these are contractual obligations, not necessarily enactments of the legislature. So I can't say that we had specific guidance from the Department of Law on that, to my awareness. But I don't believe that given that this is a commercial contract, that that would necessarily implicate that particular provision.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
No.
Okay. All right, I see no other questions.
So the next slide reflects a little bit of what we've discussed in the past regarding why the state elects to take RIK barrels versus RIV barrels. And again, this is kind of going through, you can see a little bit of mathematical equation regarding why we expect to see a premium for those RIK sales. Step one, down at the bottom of each of those boxes, you can see we start with a West Coast price. And then as you work up of each of those boxes, you see different deductions for the against the value of that oil. You can see the marine transportation allowance tends to be a little bit higher than the RIK differential for in-state sales. The other transportation costs, that's associated with pipeline transportation. That pipeline transportation is regulated tariffs that are regulated specifically by the RCA and FERC. And so there's a published tariff schedules that are subject to specific rate regulation. So those are the same whether or not it's sold in-state or out-of-state, depending on the tariff schedule. But those are subject to extensive litigation and oversight. But you can see the actual value that the state receives in this particular example reflects a higher value for the RIK oil versus the RIV oil. So again, this is part of the reason why the state pursues those in-state sales of RIK oil.
I see no questions.
So slide 17 reflects the specific RIK pricing formula. We've gone through all of these components previously, but just to run through them, we start with the ANS West Coast price, Alaska North Slope crude oil West Coast price. We subtract the RIK differential, that's the analog for the marine transportation. We subtract the tariff allowance. Part of the tariff, part of the regulated tariff structure that both FERC and RCA oversee, is the actual transportation cost in the tariff. There are two other components of that tariff structure, though. There's quality bank adjustment, which is an adjustment for the different qualities of crude oil that is going into a regulated pipeline, where you have two different sources of crude that maybe have different chemical characteristics. Those crudes might be worth slightly different values, and so it's a method of adjusting for the different values of those crude components, given that the end result, that what comes out of the pipeline is a blended crude that's made up of all of the components that are going into the pipeline in the first instance. And then the last item is line loss. Again, this is part of the regulated tariff structure. I want to stress that this is not line loss that is leaking to, you know, a gravel pad. This again has to do with the chemical composition of the different oils that are going into the pipeline. When you have two crudes with different chemical characteristics, those have different gravities, but when you blend those, occasionally, you know, two barrels with different chemical characteristics might not equal two barrels of blended crude. It may be, you know, 1.9998 barrels. And so that's where that potential line loss is coming from. It's the blending of those two crudes. If there are spills from a pipeline operation, those are reported both to DNR and to DEC. That's not what's talked about here with the line loss, though.
Yes. Senator Klayman, question.
Just on line loss, for what that effectively means is when it goes into the pipeline at Prudhoe Bay, it might be one percentage of each, and by the time it's been worked its way down the pipeline and they measure it as it come out into the pipeline, that those percentage might have changed slightly.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, I think that's closer to the quality bank, but yeah, very, very similar. It just has to do with the chemical characteristics of the different crude streams that are getting combined. The line loss refers to kind of the actual physical shrinkage, effectively, of the barrels of oil that are going into the pipeline together, where you might put, you know, two barrels in and get 1.9998 barrels out at the other end of the line, just again because of the chemical characteristics of the oil. A friend who was an engineer once described it as, you know, the equivalent of mixing a barrel of water with a barrel of, you know, large rocks, and, you know, you put the two together and you don't necessarily get two barrels, just, you know, different size of different chemical components.
Thank you.
All right, I see no further questions.
So the next slide reflects a history of several different sort of price components. Over time here, you can see the marine deduction, the actual marine transportation cost. And then below that, we have the volume-weighted average RIK differential. This is what the department has historically received for its RIK differential, that negotiated sort of fixed price that we discussed earlier. And then comparatively, we have the DOR location differential minus 24 cents. Mm-hmm. And so this allows the committee to actually see the difference in those two pricing terms, what we've done historically versus what we're proposing to move to with this new contract. And so you can see the bottom line there. I believe it's green. It might not quite show up for the committee or for folks at home. But that bottom green line reflects the pricing term that we're moving to. As you can see, it does bounce around a little bit more than the negotiated price that we've got. In part, that's because the negotiated price is fixed. In part, that's because it's an average of a couple of different negotiated prices that we have. But there are years where, more years than not, where we expect that to do a little bit better for the state. But again, more importantly, from the department's perspective, it makes that pricing term robust over time and means that we're avoiding the risk that the market moves against us over the term of that contract. So from the department's perspective, it's as much about risk management as it is about trying to, you know, eke out a little bit better a deal.
Question, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're talking about marine transportation deductions and the like. Obviously, we're not taking it to Washington or California, but we do still have a little bit of marine transportation from Valdez over to Nikiski. How is that factored in?
Senator Myers, through the chair. Yeah, thank you. Really good question. Actually, it allows me to make a point that I hadn't made before. When the state sells RIK barrels, we actually don't – the state doesn't undertake any physical transportation or physical holding of that oil. We actually sell that oil at the point of production, essentially at the unit boundary. So when we talk about the cost of transportation, that's a deduction that the state sees against the value of its oil, because Marathon then has to pay for the transportation cost of moving that oil from the North Slope down to Valdez. It actually incurs the tariff costs. It makes sense for Marathon to undertake that. They have other contracts where they're purchasing oil up on the North Slope. Mm-hmm. So they already have accounts with the pipeline companies, the different shippers, and they actually operate a small fleet of tankers that they use to move oil from Valdez to their refinery. They also occasionally purchase oil from out of state. Again, going back to the chemical composition of oil, sometimes they need to purchase oil that has different chemical properties for the different products that they're producing. But yeah, the cost of marine transportation is something Marathon incurs.
Very good. I see no further questions.
Okay. Thank you. This slide summarizes the benefits to the state of Alaska that the department sees from the sale of royalty in kind oil. As we discussed before, it results in premiums to the state. On an annual basis, we expect that this contract will generate between $4 million to $6 million in incremental additional revenue over and above what we would expect to receive from royalty and value. The actual value of this contract on an annual basis is hundreds of millions of dollars, and so that is all money that is coming to the state. But compared to what we would expect to see for the same volume of royalty production if we were just simply to receive it in value, that's where we expect to see this $4 to $6 million premium on an annual basis. So even just over the initial three-year term of the contract, that would be $12 to about $18 million that we'd expect to receive in additional value for the state. Additionally, selling this oil as royalty in kind to Marathon Petroleum does help to support the in-state refining sector. The Nikiski refinery supports about 220 jobs in addition to contracting positions. Majority of those are in Nikiski, but there are other positions that are supported in Anchorage as well. The Nikiski refinery produces a wealth of different fuels that are used throughout the state. It produces close to half of the jet fuel that's used at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. It produces a large percentage of the gasoline that's used in the state. It produces low sulfur diesel that's used throughout the state and in operations up on the North Slope. And it does have some capacity for producing asphalt that's used in in-state transportation projects as well. So from DNR's perspective, both the additional revenue from the economic impact and from the fuel security, we see this as having significant benefit to the state of Alaska.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki, question. Yeah,
thank you. So I know there's not a lot of competition for refiners in state, but what if I wanted to start my own refinery and I had the wherewithal, I had the funding, I was in an area like Nikiski, and my pitch would be that, you know, the same number of people, but I wanted to sell gas at a discounted price, or I wanted to do something that would also benefit Alaskans, but not necessarily the state financially. Would that be taken into equation? Could we sell royalty in-kind gas to a company that wants to sell it at a lower rate to encourage or promote business, for instance, or maybe be the cheapest gas station at the Fairbanks or the Anchorage International Airport?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, thank you for the question. Right now, the statutes that DNR operates under direct us to attempt to receive a premium versus sales of RIV oil. So I don't believe that we would be able to sell oil at a discount for other in-state purposes under the statutes that we currently operate under. Obviously, you know, changing those would be a question for the legislature.
Okay. Thank you.
I see no other questions.
All right. And that is the end of our presentation.
Thank you. Very thorough presentation. Senator Myers, question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So we've gone over selling the royalty oil. I was wondering if you could just give me the two-minute version of the other end of it, of the the arrangements with the producers on whether or not we take our royalty in kind or in value.
Thank you very much, Senator Myers. Yeah, that's a really good question. When the state enters into one of these contracts to sell its royalty oil as royalty in kind, we have a nomination period that's built into those oil and gas contracts. So we have to give our producers a certain amount of notice ahead of time that we're going to elect to take our oil as royalty in kind. So there is notice to the producer. There's, you know, they have the opportunity then to adjust their own sales contracts, essentially respond to like the commercial market in terms of the amount of oil that they're going to be marketing, whether that's in state or out of state themselves. Additionally, we do tend to work with producers that may have a preference for having oil nominated as in kind or in value where there's an opportunity to do so. We may also attempt to work with our purchasers when it comes to nominating from particular fields. They may have a preference for certain fields where they already have pipeline capacity that they, you know, have contracted into, or, you know, have commercial arrangements already with pipeline operators to receive oil from particular fields. So it is something where we're working with not just the producers that we're taking that royalty in kind from, making sure that they know what to expect and what's coming, but then also on the refiner's end, which fields those are coming from as well.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Just looking at Section 1, it says, line 9, the legislature approves and ratifies the agreement for the sale of royalty oil between and among the state of Alaska and Marathon Petroleum Supply. We don't have that agreement in paper in front of us. We do, if you go online, there's a draft agreement that's not signed. Is that the agreement that we're ratifying?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes, that's correct. The department doesn't execute that agreement until it receives the authorization from the legislature to do so. So the agreement that is part of the final best interest finding is the agreement that is in front of the legislature. And referencing back to Senator Klayman's question from earlier, there wouldn't be an amendment to that contract unless that also came before the legislature.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
And just looking at that agreement, there's just a couple sections I had questions on, and one was 6.1, which talks about credit rating. And it says if the credit rating is no longer reasonably likely to remain below either BBB minus, Standard & Poor, or BAA3 with Moody's, there are commitment requirements that factor in. What is Marathon's current credit rating in both of those issue and both of those services?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, off the top of my head, I don't know what Marathon's current credit rating is. The references to credit rating in our agreements reflect predominantly the security that we negotiate as part of these RIK sales. As part of the commercial agreement between the state and our purchasers, we typically have some form of security bonding around the payment of the oil that they are purchasing from the state. And so we'll have, it may be a bond issued by, you know, an insurance company. It may be a letter of credit issued by a bank, but some form of financial assurance from the purchasers. Essentially, as they, you know, purchase oil from the state, payment terms are typically, payment within, 30 days or 45 days. As they're purchasing that oil, accruing that liability, we want to make sure that if there's a financial default from our counterparty, that the state is covered by that. And so we look at the credit rating of our counterparties to help determine the amount of that financial assurance. But for all of these contracts, we do require some form of financial assurance to cover typically at least 1 month cycle and usually several month cycles of payment, so that if there is a financial default, that the state does still receive the payment for that oil that it's already sold.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Section 21.1, assignments and other transfers, says buyer may freely assign its rights and obligations to an affiliate. Goes on to say buyer and guarantor may, without consent of the state, collectively assign their rights and obligations under this agreement to a person that acquires all or substantially all of the Alaska refining assets. So with or without consent, or without consent rather, they can assign their obligations or their rights under this agreement. Is that to anybody? Could that be – I know we've had another bill in this committee about concerns about adversarial countries. Could it – Sinopec, for instance, acquire the assets of Marathon, and then we would be obligated to continue to sell them the oil or provide them the oil?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, this particular contract allows for the assignment of the contract to a new purchaser of Marathon Refinery. However, if there was an attempt to purchase an in-state energy asset by a different country, there are several other forums where that particular purchase would be scrutinized. It wouldn't necessarily be part of this contract, but both at the state and federal level, those sorts of purchases are reviewed.
Follow-up. Senator Wilikowski.
Would there be anything wrong with adding a provision to the contract to say to limit who this could be sold to? I know because of the concerns that have been raised in this committee and I know by the president, because the way I read this, they could sell it to Sinopec, for example, just as to pick a name out, which is a Chinese oil and gas company. Is there any provision that would ban them from selling to an out-of-state in this contract, per se?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that is something that we could explore in future contracts. Again, this particular contract, having already gone through that notice and comment period, royalty review period, at this point we'd have to restart that process in order to add that provision. However, as I indicated before, any sort of sale of energy assets to a foreign buyer, especially a foreign buyer from a jurisdiction that may have foreign jurisdiction that may be less than friendly to the United States, those sales are reviewed by the federal government and by the state government in other contexts. And so it's not typically something that we include in this particular contract, but that is because those assurances exist in other forums to review and authorize or prevent those sales if it's against the state or national interest.
Further questions? Thank you. I will call you in a moment, Senator Hughes. It is my intention to adjourn this meeting in 5 minutes. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I'm just following up to Senator Wilikowski. I do think that the federal government or the state government might look into it, but if it's something that a private company is making a negotiating with another country, I'm not sure, unless there's a law to prevent that. I don't know that there'd be any jurisdiction that they could actually stop it. They could review it, but I don't think they could stop it.
Any further questions? Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. Just briefly, was this negotiated in this before or after ConocoPhillips acquired Marathon?
Apologies. Senator Kawasaki through the chair. There's actually two different Marathon oil companies. There is Marathon, I believe, Oil and Gas, and then there's Marathon Petroleum. At some point in the past, the Marathon oil company split into two companies that reflected both its exploration and production activities and its refining activities. ConocoPhillips purchased the exploration and production Marathon company and merged it into ConocoPhillips. The company that operates the Marathon refinery in Nikiski is the refining Marathon. Okay. It's a separate corporation and was not the Marathon that was acquired by ConocoPhillips.
All right. Thank you for the clarification.
Any other questions? All right. Senator Klayman.
Just a follow-up on Senator Wilikowski's question. As a practical matter, as a committee and as a legislator, what we were presented with is a proposal and a contract, and our choice is either to approve the contract or not approve the contract. We have no authority. Or if we want to negotiate different terms and say our choice would be to reject it and say go back and renegotiate because we can't dicker with the terms that are here.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, yes, that's correct. It is essentially an up or down vote. in order to modify the terms at this point, we would have to restart that public process from the beginning of the negotiation through the best interest finding and royalty board review.
Further questions? All right, seeing none. Thank you for the presentation. I do need to adjourn this meeting early. Several members of this committee have a meeting at 5 p.m. that they need to be at. So we don't have time to hear testimony from Mr. Sullivan, who has called in for Marathon Petroleum, nor do we have time to move the bill today. So it will be the first item on Friday, and I will look for public testimony and moving the bill at that time. Right now we're going to conclude our meeting. The next meeting will be on Friday, April 25th at 3:30 p.m. We're going to consider governor appointees. There are six of them. We're going to hear Senate Bill 32, allowable costs for electrical cooperative rates, and we're going to hear Senate Bill 180, LNG import facilities. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect it as 4:55, but no members should leave until they've signed the two bills. Thank you.